Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
We talk a lot about the sexual revolution, sometimes without even defining it, but what if the sexual revolution were merely, as big as it is, merely part of a greater, perhaps longer revolution, perhaps a revolution of the self, how we think about ourselves that began long before the 1960s and has its roots far back in romantic and then later kind of a sexualized psychological philosophy. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about the revolution of self, Dr. Carl Truman. He's professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and author of several books, including Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity and Sparked the Sexual Revolution. Dr. Truman, welcome back.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Why is it that to object to something like same-sex marriage today is considered the moral equivalent of being racist?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the answer is, well, there are a couple of aspects to the answer. One is we tend to very much identify ourselves with our feelings today. And so anybody who says anything that it hinders our feelings, makes us feel bad, is regarded as somehow inhibiting or denying us as a person. And I think we all agree that racism is something that does that. When you use a racial epithet, when you make a derogatory comment about somebody because of their skin color, you're essentially denying their humanity. You're denigrating them in some way. I think we now live in a world where it's not simply racial categories, but also sexual categories that shape that psychological space. And therefore, to say to a gay couple, you know, you may think you're married, but you're not married. That's not actual marriage in which you are engaged. That isn't simply to object to a practice in which they're engaged in. It's also to deny them who they think they really are. It's a way of putting them down, refusing to acknowledge their fundamental humanity. And so the logic, if you like, the cultural logic of the two situations in modern society is very, very similar.
What is expressive individualism, and how is it at the heart of the revolution in selfhood?
Well, expressive individualism really connects in some ways to the answer I just gave on the gay marriage racism front. Expressive individualism is this idea that who we are is really the collection of feelings that we have, if you like, who you are and who I am. It's really who we are on the inside. It's our emotions, it's our desires, it's our self-image. It's formed in that psychological space. And therefore, to be authentic is for me to be able to act out in public that which I feel inwardly. So, for example, on the issue of sexuality, if my inward sexual desires are for somebody of the same sex, and society says to me, you can't act out on those desires, then society is making me inauthentic. It's forcing me to be somebody in public that I am not really. And that's really the modern revolution in selfhood. If you were to go back to the Middle Ages, your understanding of who you are would be pretty much externally determined. You'd be born in a certain place. You'd fit into a certain fixed place in the hierarchy. You would have a certain job that would have been one that was the same as your father and your father's father and your father's father had done. Everything that made you was external. That's not our world now. The external world is very fluid, and we see our identity as wrapped up with inner feelings.
We use this term all the time, the sexual revolution. What is it?
Yeah, interesting question. Typically, we think, certainly conservative Christian types, think the sexual revolution is simply a loosening up of sexual behavior or a broadening of society's understanding of what is acceptable sexual behavior. In fact, the sexual revolution is more radical than that. The sexual revolution since the 50s and 60s involves a fundamental change in what we see as the significance of sexual behavior. Once upon a time, sexual behavior was seen as significant because it sealed marriage, it produced children. now we see sexual behavior as recreational. Once upon a time, certain sexual acts were seen as intrinsically wrong. A sexual act between a man and a man was seen as intrinsically wrong, whatever the circumstances of its performance. Now we tend to think in terms of sexual acts as wrong because one of the parties involved did not consent to what is going on. So the sexual revolution really involves a fundamental transformation in how we think about sex, what we see sex's function to be, and where we see the morality of sex as grounded.
How have even Christians become complicit in this revolution of self?
In numerous ways, but I think perhaps the most obvious would be our approach to marriage. Many Christians, if you say to Christians, when's marriage redefined in the United States? Many would probably answer 2015, Obergefell v. Hodges, when a majority on the Supreme Court fined gay marriage to be protected by the Constitution. In actual fact, I think marriage is redefined in 1970, when Ronald Reagan signs no-fault divorce into law in the state of California. You might say, well, why do you say that? Well, if you think about it, no-fault divorce turns marriage into a sentimental bond designed for the happiness of the persons involved. And as soon as the people involved or one of the people involved in marriage is no longer being made to feel happy by the other, they can exit the relationship, they can exit the arrangement, simply on the basis that, hey, it isn't working for me anymore. That changes marriage from a lifelong bond for rich or for poor in sickness and health into a sentimental arrangement that's designed for my happiness, for my self-expression, for my fulfillment. That's the heart of expressive individualism. That's the heart of the sexual revolution. And of course, most churches didn't bat an eyelid at the arrival of no-fault divorce. So I would say no-fault divorce is one key area where the church has been complicit in what's gone on.
Who were the foundational romantic philosophers of the self?
Well, if you go back to the 18th century, I would say the key figure in many ways is Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Obviously, no thinker exists in isolation. But Rousseau is the man who really gives sharp articulation to the idea that it's civilized society that corrupts us, and what we really need to do is get back to nature. Nature will allow us to get in touch with our inner selves without it being that relationship between the inner and outer self being perverted by the demands of polite society. And Rousseau's thinking is really very influential in Germany on figures such as Schiller and Hölderlin, and in Britain on poets such as William Wordsworth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Lord Byron to an extent, and William Blake. So they're the key figures, I would say, in the literary firmament that make Rousseau's kind of notion of the self popular.
How were the ideas of these romantics taken up by thinkers like Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche?
Yeah, the interesting relationship. I mean, all of those figures, Hegel, Marx, and Nietzsche, are kind of in reaction to the romantics to some extent. I think what they share in common with the romantics is an assumption that traditional orthodox theism, orthodox Christianity, is no longer an option. And what each of those three figures does in their own distinctive way is weaken the idea of human nature as a given. Hegel's a key figure here, but for Hegel, human nature is always in process. It's not something given. It's not a static thing. It's something that changes over time. Marx, of course, builds upon that in a different way, but Marx, too, latches onto that idea that human nature is something that's in process. And Nietzsche, from his own perspective, rejects the idea of human nature. You might say, well, what's the significance of that? Well, the significance is this. If you have a fixed human nature, then we could say there's a fixed moral structure for what it means to be a human being. If you deny human nature, as Nietzsche does, or you turn human nature into something that's always in process, you inject the distinct possibility for a radical moral relativism, historical relativism, into the picture.
So what did Nietzsche, Marx, and Charles Darwin do with human identity and, in particular, morality?
Well, again, building off my last answer, what the three of them do in their different ways is, first of all, they reject the idea of a static notion of human nature. In other words, they reject the idea that just because something is wrong in, let's say, ancient Greece, it should still be wrong in the 19th or 20th century. Secondly, particularly with Darwin, although it's there in Nietzsche and Marx as well, particularly with Darwin, Darwin destroys the idea of what we call human exceptionalism. Basically, prior to the 19th century, it was assumed, even by the Romantics, that, okay, there may be no God. We may not be made in God's image, therefore, but human beings are still exceptional compared to all other creatures on the face of the planet. Different rules apply to us. With Darwin, no, we're not exceptional. We're simply the latest result of a fairly random process of evolution that's taken place over a long period of time. And therefore, any arguments built upon human exceptionalism, any arguments built on the fact that human beings are different, are no longer valid. And we might see, you might say, well, give me an example of that. One good example would be the way Peter Singer, the Princeton ethicist, argues for infanticide. Peter Singer makes the legitimate point that human beings, we routinely kill animals for no other reason than we want a good beef burger. You know, we slay calves in order to provide mince, in order to make delicious hamburgers. Peter Singer would say, so why can't we kill little babies to make hamburgers with? He's not promoting that as an idea, but he'd say, why is it that we think killing babies is wrong and killing cows is legitimate? Well, the answer comes back was because human beings are special. We're made in the image of God. And Singer would say, well, no, you can't use that as an argument because we're not exceptional. And if you're going to kill cows, then we should be able to kill human beings at a similar stage of intellectual development. So that would be one example of where Darwin's erosion and elimination of the distinction between human beings and other animals has dramatic ethical implications.
How has a sexualized psychology and politics become the dominant worldview? Who are the thinkers there?
Key thinker there, I think, although he was not particularly political, is Sigmund Freud. Freud is the man who, more than anybody else, makes the shift between seeing sex as something we do to seeing sex as something we are. We're very familiar with that now when we think about LGBTQ stuff. If somebody says, I'm a lesbian or I'm a gay, they're not necessarily telling you about any act they may have engaged in. They may actually be virgins. They may have no sexual experience at all. What they're saying to you is that I have these sexual desires for people of the same sex. And they're saying more than that. What they're actually saying is, and that is a fundamental part of who I am. My sexual desire is part of my identity. Now, this is picked up by thinkers in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, particularly on the left, people like Wilhelm Reich and Herbert Marcuse, though it's no longer a monopoly of the left, to say, you know, if people are identifying themselves in terms of their sexual desires, then laws that determine what sexual desires can be expressed and those which must remain unexpressed are not simply laws about sexual behavior. They're actually laws about who society will and will not allow you to be. And at that point, of course, it becomes obvious that Freud's move of making sexual desire part of human identity must inevitably make human sexual codes political, because they cease to be about behavior and become about who you're allowed to be by society.
Dr. Carl Truman is our guest. He's author of several books, including Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity and Sparked the Sexual Revolution. He just mentioned Wilhelm Reich. We'll hear more about him next.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come.
16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Come and hear abortion survivor Melissa Odin, Jeannie Mancini from the March for Life, and Blaze TV and radio host Steve Dace at the 2022 Lutherans for Life National Conference, Friday and Saturday, October 21st and 22nd in Rock Island, Illinois. Lutherans for Life National Conferences provide valuable information and encouragement to you, your congregation, and your community. The 2022 Lutherans for Life National Conference, October 21st and 22nd in Rock Island, Illinois. Learn more at lutheransforlife.org/conference.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Come and experience firsthand by sitting down in classes and actually hearing professors, coming to chapel, which is always the high point of the day, to hear the Word of God and to lift our voices in song.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Paul Grimm on why you should consider visiting Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Spend time talking to professors. I mean, there's not a professor here who will not be willing to take time, whether it's after chapel during the coffee hour or just to come into one study and sit down and talk for a while, to answer questions, to help them to get a sense of, A, do they want to be a pastor or a deaconess? And then B, is this the right place? And, maybe C would be the question, is now the right time for them to make that decision?
If you've contemplated the vocation of pastor or deaconess, contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or send an email to admission@ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the revolution of self with Dr. Carl Truman of Grove City College. Dr. Truman, before the break, you had mentioned Wilhelm Reich. Who was he, and how does he serve in some ways as a link between the previous thinkers and the modern sexual revolution?
Yeah, Wilhelm Reich's an interesting figure. He was an assistant to Freud in the early 20th century, though Freud found him too extreme. Reich was an interesting fusion of Freudianism and Marxism, and Reich saw sexual codes as a means for social domination. He was really wrestling with he was a German, and he was wrestling with why is it that the working classes are becoming increasingly authoritarian? Why is it they're supporting Nazism rather than socialism? And his answer was really because the nuclear family trains children to obey a dominant father figure. And when you grow up and leave home, you then look for the new dominant father figure. Your biological father, you've left him behind, but you're always looking for the dominant father figure, and they found it in the Führer, in Adolf Hitler. So Reich's notion was, if you want to politically revolutionize people's consciousness, you've got to smash the family. You've got to smash the nuclear family. And the way to do that is to smash the sexual codes by which society strengthens and regulates the nuclear family. In other words, if we put it bluntly, you've got to take sex education away from the parents and give it to the hands of the political radicals. That's the way to revolutionize society. And he writes this up in a book in 1936 entitled The Sexual Revolution. This book is really a book written out of time. It has little impact in the 1930s, but becomes something of a sacred text to the student revolutionaries of 1968. And of course, 1968, the student revolutions of 1968, really turbocharged and set the trajectory for the modern sexual politics with which we are living today. So Reich is the man who in 1930s is laying the intellectual foundations for the sexual revolution of the 60s and beyond.
What is the plastic self?
Plastic self is a term I use for the idea that human beings, we no longer think of ourselves, or we no longer experience the world as one where we are stable and fixed. We tend to think of ourselves as, we use this language of being able to reinvent ourselves, start again. We can move houses, we can choose new, we can change careers, we choose where we go to college, we choose whom we marry. Whereas 600 years ago, life was very static and very given, and you had to fit into the community into which you were born and into the role into which you were born. Now, our feelings of who we are much more flexible and pliable than that. We're taught we can be anything we want to be. So the plastic self is the idea that we ourselves should be our own inventions.
Talk about the collapse of traditional authority.
Yeah, traditional authority has the collapse of traditional authority. It's a complicated story, but again, it's probably we can make it clear by drawing a contrast with the Middle Ages. If you're born in the Middle Ages, you'd have been born, you've lived and died probably within 40 miles of one place. You'd basically have lived in one town or one village that would have been the center of your life. Generation to generation, the rhythm of life, the nature of life would not have changed very much. You'd have been born a peasant farmer, as your grandfather and his grandfather and his grandfather before him were. You'd have worshipped, you'd have been baptized, worshipped, married, and buried in the same church. Everything would have been very, very fixed. That all starts to change in the 16th century, particularly with the advent of the printing press and then later industrialization. Technology transforms the way we relate to the environment around us. Technology truly does revolutionize human existence. Geography no longer has the hold on us that it once had. Time becomes something over which we can exert control. If you're a farmer, you've got to observe the seasons. If you're a podcast host, man, you can record podcasts any day of the year. You are no longer subject to the rhythm of the seasons, to the rhythm of the time as you once were. So really from the 16th, but accelerating from the 19th century onwards, technology fundamentally transforms how human beings experience the world and encourages us to believe that we are not subject to authority, external authority, but we ourselves have the power to reshape the world around us. And that plays out in all kinds of ways in modern society, but goes to the heart of a rejection, if you like, today, of certainly of traditional notions of external authority.
What do you mean when you talk about the triumph of the erotic?
Yeah, again, it connects somewhat to the notion of the sexualized politics in which we operate today. The most powerful forces, or some of the most powerful forces in the world today, connect to the politics of sexual identity, to the nature of sexual desire. What we've seen over the last 40, 50 years is sex and the sexualization of what it means to become a human being become dominant forces within our culture. Sex has always been powerful. You go back and you read the Iliad, Homer's Iliad, it still makes sense to us today because we understand, yeah, men commit adultery, women run off with men who aren't their husbands. We can identify with that. Those things have been perennials throughout human existence. Human beings have always engaged in these kind of things. We know that the sexual desire is very, very powerful. But what we see today is an empowerment and a politicization of that desire that has really come to reshape society. We witness it almost every day when you turn on the news now and you hear about the great battles going on in public education over sex education. There you see the erotic has moved to the forefront of educational philosophical discussion. So the triumph of the erotic is really another word for the broader implications of the sexual revolution.
What role did technology, in particular the development of the pill, play in advancing the sexual revolution?
What technology does is it really enables us to imagine that, sex can be recreation. My wife and I were walking back to a hotel a few weeks ago. We were staying overnight in a town in Pennsylvania. Walking back to our hotel, we walked through a small pro-abortion protest. And one of the banners read, consent to sex is not consent to pregnancy. And I commented to my wife, well, 200 years ago, consent to sex was certainly consent to the possibility of pregnancy. That sign only makes sense. That sign is only possible in a world where contraception has led us to believe that pregnancy, if you like, is an occasional and unfortunate side effect of sex and not the primary purpose of sex. So the pill and reproductive technology has really shaped the way we think about sex. It's really shaped, if you like, the sexual imagination and allowed us to think of sex as cost-free recreation rather than something that only makes sense and is only sensible to do within the context of a committed long-term relationship.
Why was this alliance that we generally recognize by the acronym LGBTQ always a marriage of convenience? And of late, I should know, we are watching it begin to dissolve where there are those who want to be LGB without the T.
Yeah, or the Q. Yeah, well, when you think about it, L and G and B all assume that gender and sex are basically the same thing. That being a biological man makes you a male. Being a biological female makes you a female. Gay men are not sexually attracted to women who identify as men. The biology of those women is critical to the nature of the sexual desire of gay men. So it's a marriage of convenience because the T and the Q deny that. They deny that there is any close connection or necessary connection between bodily sex and what they call gender. And therefore, the alliance is not an alliance of internal agreement. It's an alliance really brought about by an external enemy. And the external enemy is what they would call white male heteronormativity, the idea that white straight males get to set the rules for what is normal sexual desire and normal sexual activity. That is something that binds together the L, the G, the B, the T, and the Q. They all reject that normativity. But once white male heteronormativity declines in power, which it is doing before our very eyes at this moment, then the power of the common enemy to keep the alliance together is also diminished, and the alliance itself starts to break apart, which, as you noted, is what we're beginning to see as gay men and lesbian women find themselves at loggerheads with the trans and the queer lobby.
So where did trans ideology enter the picture, and why, as you say, why can it not be avoided?
Trans ideology, I think, really becomes a powerful force in American culture around about 2015, when Bruce Jenner gives his famous, you know, he comes out as trans and he gives his famous interview with Diane Sawyer for 60 Minutes. That was what really galvanized the trans movement. It had been a fellow traveler with the L, the G, and the B because of the reasons I gave in my last answer. It starts to take on its own power really from 2015. And of course, in the current administration, I'm not making a party political point here, but it's simply an observable fact that the current president and his administration have been very favorable to trans ideology and have promoted the trans issue quite strongly, both in personnel appointments and in the kind of policies they've been trying to develop. So really moves to center stage 2015 onwards. Why is it hard to avoid? Well, because it's disrupting so much. There's a sense in which if I live in a road where the couple next door happen to be a gay couple who are married, it doesn't really interfere with my life very much. If a trans person wants to use the bathroom I use or the bathroom my daughter uses at school,
a male pretending to be a woman wants to compete in the sports at the local high school, well, that interferes with my life. If my employer starts telling me I've got to use the preferred pronouns of somebody who, to me, is obviously a man, but is pretending to be a woman, and I now have to pretend that this person is a woman and use his preferred pronouns, that's interfering with my life. The trans issue is not a live and let live issue. It's a fundamental assertion about what it means to be a human being that demands everybody else conform to it and invades their private space and invades their linguistic space in very intrusive ways. And that's why we're all going to face this issue in dramatic ways in the coming months and years.
Dr. Carl Truman of Grove City College is our guest. The Revolution of Self is our topic. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues Etc. Folks, the 2022 Lutherans for Life National Conference begins late next week, October 21st and 22nd in Rock Island, Illinois. You can meet and hear radio host Steve Dace, Jeannie Mancini of the March for Life, and abortion survivor Melissa Oden. Find out more at lutheransforlife.org/conference. And while you're there, be sure to check out the Y for Life in Washington, D.C. and Lutherans for Life at the National March for Life in January of 2023. Lutheransforlife.org/conference. When we come back, how has the revolution of selfhood built a culture of protest? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Making Disciples for Life. Across the nation, students are back in school in over 1,800 schools serving children in early childhood through high school. Students are thriving in programs of excellence in a safe, caring, Christian environment taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. Connect today for information about a Lutheran school for the children in your family at lcms.org/schools.
It's not about you. It's about Jesus for you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When pastors talk about us, they say ad crucem. When laity mention us, they say ad crucem. When telemarketers call us, they say ADC Rucam. But a Luther Rose by any name will smell as sweet. Ad crucem is the place to go for greeting cards and artwork, jewelry and ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and much more. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the revolution of self with Dr. Carl Truman of Grove City College. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Truman, how has this revolution of selfhood built a culture of protest?
Well, I think it tends to polarize people because these are often issues upon which there is no middle ground. There is no middle ground with the trans movement, for example. You either use the pronouns or you don't. And there's no happy compromise to be found there. It's non-reality versus reality. Secondly, a lot of these movements tend to have at their heart a deep and aggressive iconoclasm. We saw this with Black Lives Matter. If you look at the Black Lives Matter manifesto, it's much clearer what Black Lives Matter is against than what it's for. It wants to defund the police. It wants to tear down institutions. What is it replacing them with? Well, it wants to replace them with a world characterized by very wonderful-sounding but rather empty emotional phrases, not specific institutions.
Well, that goes to the heart of what a lot of this ideology is, and that it's fundamentally an ideology that opposes the status quo and wants to destabilize and bring down the status quo without having anything very positive to put in its place. In other words, it is intrinsically a movement of protest rather than construction.
Regarding the church, you say that we Christians are in a very different way than Christians were 500 years ago. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One, of course, would be that Christians are no longer, we can no longer assume the cultural dominance. For good or ill, we can no longer assume the cultural dominance of Christianity. But the second thing, I think, is this, and it's what the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor points to, and he makes the comment that Christians today can believe exactly the same things that Christians 500 years ago believed, but they cannot believe them in the same way. And what he's getting at there is we choose to be religious now. In the Middle Ages in Europe, you didn't choose to be religious. You were born religious. The world was unavoidably religious. It was the very air you breathed. Now we choose to be religious. And that comes with some wonderful things. It carries with it, obviously, a need for religious freedom, which is a great and a good thing. On the other hand, it also brings with it the risk of turning religion into a consumer product that we choose or we don't choose as we so desire in accordance with our own taste. So I think that's what I'm getting at there, that religion today, it's a matter of choice in a way that it wasn't 500 years ago.
How can the church then respond to this expressive individualism?
I think it can only respond, at least at this point, at a local level, by being strong community and by showing people in the way we live our lives that actually expressive individualism ultimately exalts the self and the individual. And yet individuals still have a craving to belong. We still have a craving for community. And as we see expressive individualism dissolving traditional notions of community around us, it could be a great opportunity for the church to be precisely a strong community and to offer precisely the kind of belonging to which plastic selves drowning in a sea of individualism still crave.
Talk about the future of this revolution of selfhood.
Hard to know where it will go. I mean, who would have predicted 20 years ago that the trans issue would have become such a powerful political force in our culture? People would be losing their jobs over pronoun policies. So it's very hard to predict. But if I had to predict anything, I would say, watch the transhumanist movement. Transhumanism takes various forms, but it's essentially a movement that is trying to transcend the very nature of what it means to be a human being by wedding human beings to technology and to machines in some way. I tend to think that transgenderism is a form of transhumanism. The gerrymandering of our bodies through hormone treatment and surgery is a way of trying to transcend through technology the limitations of the human body. Well, transgenderism is only one aspect of that. I think the emergence of cyborgs, the striving for immortality, technologically delivered immortality, the dream of being able to download ourselves into a computer, all of these things, maybe they'll turn out to be totally crazy pipe dreams. I have a suspicion many of them will. But that's what people were saying about transgenderism 20 years ago. So I think the continuing revolution of the self would see a continuing attempt to overcome the natural physical limitations of the human body through the use of technology.
Why is it vital that Christians recover both natural law and a high view of the physical body?
Well, I think for Christians, we're made as bodies. God made us embodied human beings. We are not souls that have bodies that we use like spacesuits. Our body is not simply a spacesuit that allows the real us, our soul, to interact with others. Our body is an integral part of who we are. When I smile at somebody, they don't say, oh, Truman's soul is adjusting knobs within his head so that the instrument which we call his body is smiling at us. We say, no, Truman is smiling at us. Our bodies are integral to who we are. We need to recapture that. It's why Christianity is a religion of resurrection. Why is Christ resurrected? Well, forgiveness of sins is not enough. When we die, our souls go to be with the Lord. Yes, but that's not enough. The job isn't completed until the day of resurrection. That's when it's really us. in the presence of God. So we need to understand that a religion of resurrection, a religion of the Bible, sees bodies as absolutely integral to who we are as people. Natural law, I think, is, you know, a lot of Protestants object to natural law. They say it's no good as an apologetic. Well, natural law isn't simply, for me, an apologetic. It's also a powerful explanatory scheme. Why is it wrong for men to have sex with other men? Because our bodies are not designed to do that. It does incalculable damage, as the government health statistics indicate. Now, that on its own is not an argument for the immorality of male-to-male sexual activity, but it certainly helps us understand why the Bible teaches the way it does. And I find this, talking to young people at Grove City College, you give them the Bible verses on ethics, and they believe them and they trust them. Back it up with natural law, and the argument becomes that much more powerful, because then they realize, well, God doesn't just say that because he's an arbitrary tyrant. God says that because that actually reflects the way he's made the world to be. So I think natural law is going to be very important in teaching the rising generation of young Christians not only what the Bible says, but that the Bible says what it says for particular reasons.
What can we learn from early Christians to help us resist the revolution of self?
I think we learn what it means to be pilgrim communities. How did the early church succeed? It succeeded by being the church, by loving and caring for the people in its midst, and by extending that care to people outside the congregation. By realizing that Christianity did not necessarily mean dominating and controlling the culture. Christianity meant being faithful in the place where Christians had been placed among the people that they had been placed.
Finally, with a minute, you say that we should be neither optimistic nor pessimistic. What's the third alternative?
We should be hopeful. I think optimism is the naive belief that everything's going to get better and work out okay. It's the Pollyanna-ish idea that, you know, it'll all be okay. Don't worry. Well, that may not be the case for any one of us as individuals. Our lives may be marked by suffering, and for all of us, unless the Lord comes, our lives are going to involve the loss of loved ones and then the loss of our own lives. That's hard. That's not something that to look forward to at all. So optimism, I think, is not an option. It makes us naive, and it makes us it sets us up for despair. Despair, on the other hand, makes us impotent. Pessimism makes us impotent. If we think that the world is just going to go to the dogs and there's nothing we can do, then it makes us passive in the face of all that's going on. But we as Christians can be hopeful. We know who wins. The Lord's going to win in the end. The church is going to win in the end. That's our hope. We may not be around here on earth to see it. But because we have that hope, we work here and now to preserve the gospel and to preserve the good, the true, and the beautiful for the generation that rises after us, and we trust that they will do the same. So we need to be hopeful, knowing that our hope is laid up in Christ, and knowing that that is the motive for our actions. It doesn't mean that we think naively, we're going to survive this, but that's not the point. The point is for us to be faithful and leave a foundation for the kingdom.
Dr. Carl Truman is professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College. He's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and author of several books, including Strange New World, How Thinkers and Activists Redefined Identity and Sparked the Sexual Revolution. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Truman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Tuesday on Issues Etc., we'll conclude our interview with demographer Lyman Stone about a new survey of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod members, and we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on the call of Jeremiah, Jeremiah's letter to the exiles, the new covenant, and the Lord's eternal covenant with David. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.